My title is The Indispensable Evangelical, Carl F. H. Henry and Evangelical Ambition in the 20th Century. Is this an overstatement? Well, to some degree, certainly it is. Charles de Gaulle pointed out that cemeteries are filled with indispensable men. On the other hand, I'm going to argue that it is true. Historians of the founding era of the United States increasingly understand the indispensability of certain men and others who figured in the founding of this nation in such a way that in retrospect their importance looms larger rather than less consequential. James Thomas Flexner, in his Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, it was originally four volumes, he reduced it down to one. It was entitled George Washington, the Indispensable Man. In the actual book, he changed from arguing about an indispensable man to Washington's indispensable role. I would argue that Carl Henry had a similar stature within the evangelical movement in the United States in the 20th century. However, if you're talking about either George Washington or Carl Henry, it is very important to recognize that they were not indispensable alone. They were indispensable in collegiality and in co-working with others. Recently, speaking of the so-called Arab Spring in the Middle East, columnist George Will pointed out that the Middle East has all the makings of democracy, everything they need with the exception of George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. Well, looking at the evangelical movement, certainly in the midpoint of the 20th century, it would be impossible to tell that story without Harold John Ockingay, without Billy Graham, or without Carl Henry, and certainly to both of these lists, both the federal and the evangelical list, others could and should be added. Some of them lesser known, some of them better known, but it is certainly true when we're speaking of Carl Henry that we are not wrong to describe him as the indispensable evangelical. In 1985, when World Publishing put out its series Makers of the Modern Theological Mind, Bob Patterson at Baylor chose the volume on Carl Henry for himself, even as he was the general editor of the series. And as he explained in the foreword to that book, as the editor of the series, I had to select an or the outstanding American evangelical theologian about whom to write a book. That choice was simplicity itself, Carl F. H. Henry. Of course, Carl Henry is the prime interpreter of evangelical theology, one of its leading theoreticians, and now in his 70s, the unofficial spokesman for the entire tradition. Later, he wrote, Carl Henry has been the prime mover in helping evangelical theology in America reassert its self-respect. In 1978, Time magazine named Carl Henry evangelicalism's leading theologian. In his obituary in the New York Times, published on December the 13th of 2003, Lori Goodstein described Carl Henry as the, quote, brain of the evangelical movement, end quote. That was actually the headline of the obituary as it ran. She didn't come up with that herself. Within the obituary, it was clear that she got that statement from none other than David Neff, then the editor of Christianity Today, who had told the New York Times, quote, if we see Billy Graham as the great public face and generous spirit of the evangelical movement, Carl Henry was the brains. Lori Goodstein picked up on that, describing Henry merely as the brain of the evangelical movement. She wrote, in more than 40 books he wrote or edited, Dr. Henry laid out an intellectual defense both for a literal understanding of Scripture and for the imperative of spreading the faith. She went on to conclude, Dr. Henry helped start several of the institutional pillars of the evangelical movement, Fuller Theological Seminary, where he was the first acting dean, and the National Association of Evangelicals, in addition to Christianity Today. Several years ago, back in 2004, as a matter of fact, Paul House wrote, it is historically untenable to ignore or dismiss Carl Henry's role in the shaping of 20th century American evangelicalism. Later, House wrote, his involvement in evangelical life is well known and has been well documented by himself and others. A very well and strategically written sentence. Very well crafted. It reminded me of Winston Churchill's statement, history will be kind to me, for I intend to write it. Dr. Henry intended to do very much the same. He did not, like Augustine, write retractions. He wrote Confessions of an Evangelical Theologian. Greg Thornberry was later to write, it would be fair to say that if Billy Graham was the heart of evangelicalism, Carl F. H. Henry was its head, the man with the massive brain, a journalist pen, and an Athanasian fortitude. I was asked to write a chapter on Carl Henry for the volume Baptist Theologians, edited by Drs. Dockery and George several years ago, originally emerged in 1990. And I wrote then, in an age of declining theological vigor and few theological giants, Carl F. H. Henry has emerged as one of the theological luminaries of the 20th century. His experience as journalist, teacher, theologian, editor, and world spokesman for evangelical Christianity ranks him among the few individuals who can claim to have shaped a major movement. Now, I wrote that when Dr. Henry was still very much alive and when I knew he would be very much reading the chapter. I also knew that I would be hearing from him concerning it. I did not offer him any view of the chapter until after it was published in the book. And then he was sent a copy of the book, and I heard from him shortly thereafter. I had offered only one actual criticism, which was an underdeveloped ecclesiology. And I actually wrote of the context that explained this underdeveloped ecclesiology. It was the parachurch shape of evangelicalism made very necessary and perhaps unavoidable on the part of many of its founders by the fact that they were effectively ejected from either actual ordination or membership in the mainline Protestant denominations or from any influence in them. I got a handwritten letter from Dr. Henry. I opened it up, and it was extremely, as always, very gracious. And there was also one sentence in which he said, "I do not believe you have well represented my concern for ecclesiology. It is in God, revelation, and authority," and he offered me the 6 pages where I could find it. But I understood. I understood. He did not intend to present an underdeveloped ecclesiology. He just did not live long enough, in spite of living into a 10th decade of life, to get to that. And as I argued in that very chapter, the priorities of dealing with the epistemological, hermeneutical, and authority crisis in the larger world, as well as within evangelicalism, preempted that, not to mention the fact that he, in terms of his ministry, was never primarily identified with the congregation or with congregational responsibility. When you think about Carl Henry, and by the way, I stand by the assessment I made published back in 1990. I would not want to say less. I would only want to say more, and part of the fun of having this event is that we get to say more. We get to add to what we have previously said because we get to think more and perhaps even in concert with others in such a way that we think thoughts we otherwise might not have had the opportunity so to think. I feel that today one of the things I need to do in that light is to speak openly of my personal debt to Carl Henry and of the influence I at least know him to have in my life. As I grow older, one of the things that becomes more apparent to me is that I'm not always sure how much influence someone has in my life. Most people have more than I might recognize because they operate at a certain level which isn't always conscious. And yet, every once in a while, well, my father died just earlier this year. And increasingly, I find myself looking in the mirror and seeing my father. And I say things that I now recognize were things that I heard from my father. And in a similar way, our theological fathers have the same influence on us. My experience with Dr. Henry, in a personal way, of course, goes back to his literary and theological influence on me. And the first book that I read of his was Remaking the Modern Mind. And then also looked at many of the books that he had written about the modern mind that were actually written a generation before I read them, but appeared to be describing exactly what I was seeing and experiencing as I looked around the modern world and as I sat in a classroom at Southern Seminary in the 1980s. But I got to meet him personally when he visited Southern Seminary at the invitation of the Student Evangelical Fellowship in the 1984-1985 academic year. That's crucial for a couple of reasons, which are internal to the Southern Baptist Convention and to this institution, but would be known certainly by the people who were here at the time. Two things had happened. In 1984, that is in the year that Dr. Henry came, but before his coming, the man who was then president of the Southern Baptist Convention, Jimmy Draper, had written a book entitled Authority, the Critical Issue for Southern Baptists. What made that book unique was that a Southern Baptist Convention president was writing a book dealing with serious theological issues. That was a very important achievement for the SBC. And the second thing was that it was a way in which Dr. Draper actually brought Carl Henry and other prominent evangelicals into the Southern Baptist discussion and did so as the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. As a matter of fact, Draper's book, Authority, the Critical Issue for Southern Baptists, was largely dependent upon the work of Carl Henry and just a few others. The year previous to this, one of the most influential professors on this campus at the time, Glenn Henson, had participated in a literary project with James Leo Garrett at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, asking the question, are Southern Baptist evangelicals? Neither of them seem, in retrospect, to be convinced, actually, that we were. Garrett believed far more than Henson did that we were evangelicals, but of a sort. But Henson was adamant that Southern Baptists were not evangelicals, that evangelicals were not only of a different theological tribe, but of a different species. And he saw, as did other SBC moderates in the main, evangelical as an adjective they did not desire and a noun they did not intend to be. That SEF invitation came, and Paul House, I believe, was a part of that invitation, as were some other very brave students at that time. And yet my involvement in this came because I was at that time assistant to the president to actually my predecessor in this institution. And I received a call, and I remember it well because I had other plans at that point until I was going to go hear Dr. Henry speak at the luncheon. And Dr. Honeycutt called me and told me that we were facing an institutional challenge. And that challenge was having Dr. Carl Henry on the campus. And here was the conundrum. You had a distinguished, if not the most distinguished, evangelical theologian of our times visiting the campus, and no faculty member would then host him. Now, I want to quickly absolve Dr. George sitting on the front row. He was unavailable at this moment, but no other faculty member would host him, and so I was asked if I would host him. That's sort of like finding out that you have a visiting head of state, and you're asked if you'd like to have breakfast with him. Well, but of course. And so all of a sudden, this massive, titanic theological presence is now delivered unto me for hosting. And that was a very intimidating thing because I knew so much about Dr. Henry. I'd seen so many photographs of him. I'd heard him speak, and I knew of his roles. And so I wondered what in the world he was going to do with this 20-something who was his official host and obviously was the host in light of the fact that distinguished members of the faculty did not want to host him. So I brought him first. Before he spoke to the luncheon, he spoke to the PhD Theology Colloquium. And I'm going to go into some detail here, and I know I'm doing it on the record, and this has never been done before, but it's the time that it's done. I brought him first to the chairman of that colloquium, Dr. Frank Tupper. And at that time, the chairing of that PhD colloquium for the discipline rotated amongst the members of the senior faculty. And Dr. Tupper was at this time the chairman, and the faculty had met prior to my arrival with Dr. Henry and had decided that he was certainly welcome to participate as an observer in the colloquium, but he was not to speak. That was a very difficult thing in terms of the social etiquette of the time to try to convey, but nonetheless I did, and Dr. Henry was so incredibly gracious. He sat down, folded himself into a chair amongst students, took out that tattered leather briefcase with CH in gold on the clasp and opened it up, took out some notes, and sat and listened. The presenter that day was a student by the name of Charlie Scalise, who is now a professor at Fuller, who had written a very bright and very good paper on Brevard Childs at Yale and on what was then Child's pioneering work in terms of a new form of biblical theology and canonical theology. And at the end of the paper's presentation, the time came for questions to be asked. And I was sitting next to Dr. Henry, and I could feel the energy coming from him. But I also knew that he was exercising restraint. He said nothing. He said nothing. And at the end of the colloquium, we started to leave, and he went to Charlie Scalise and made some very kind comments about the paper, and deservedly so. And the faculty at that time waited 30 minutes after the students had begun the conversation to enter with their own comments, and at that point the faculty had entered in, and there had been a very lively debate about Hans Frey and James Barr and Brevard Childs in particular. Those three were the main issues of the conversation. after making these comments, we were walking out, and Dr. Henry always had this big briefcase with him. In fact, I never saw him without it, at least nearby. And he did something which I now do myself, which may be just a form of some kind of strange evangelical academic nerddom, or I don't know what, but I tend to carry my most recent projects with me even when they're done. I don't know if any of you do that. If so, if not, I've just exposed myself in a particular eccentricity. But I will carry things because I'm still thinking about them, and I might want to make some, even after I've delivered the paper, I might want to draw it out and make some note on it, so I have it with me. And Dr. Henry did this. He had these manila envelopes, and they weren't folders, they were envelopes. And he had them, and he had these things written on them, and he pulled them out, and I'll never forget where we were standing when all of a sudden he pulls them out and he hands them to me. So I looked at them. The first one was Debate with Brevard Childs, 2 weeks previous at Yale. The next one I picked up was Dialogue with Hans Frey, Union League Club, I believe it was, of New York City. The third one was Debate with James Barr, Tyndall Fellowship, Edinburgh. All these within the last few weeks. So here was a faculty discussing Brevard Childs and Hans Frey and James Barr, and here was the man who had actually not only written about them, but just recently engaged with them, who was not speaking in the colloquium. That did not keep him from speaking thereafter. We had a great deal of conversation thereafter. And he went on to speak to the Student Evangelical Fellowship. Walking to lunch, where he would address the SEF, I learned that Dr. Henry could talk and walk at equal pace. He was a torrent of conversation. How I wish I could now replay all of those conversations. He connected so many dots. He was able to put so many places and people on a map, a theological map, an intellectual map of conversation. He could also challenge you as you walked. I was writing my dissertation on Karl Barth and American Evangelicalism. So at one point during this visit, he decided to grill me on my reading of Karl Barth, and he asked me a question. I was so glad I was able to answer it. But I answered it because, as you know, in the church dogmatics, there is big print and there is little print. And the minuscula often is where the most important material is to be found. Dr. Henry's walking along said, always read the minuscula. That's where, he said, Barth is at his greatest and his most dangerous. He grilled me another reading as well. He would ask me questions just in casual conversation. There wasn't always a whole lot of pleasantries. He was always very kind about that, but you got immediately into epistemology. We were driving to dinner one night, and he turns to me in the car, and he says, which is prior, correspondence or coherence? I was more concerned about which is better, Italian or French. And instead, I was deep into epistemology. And so as I was driving, I quickly said, correspondence is prior. Coherence is meaningful only after correspondence. And he said, we can eat now. And we did. He spoke very kindly but clearly to the Student Evangelical Fellowship. He placed his concerns within the context, as he knew, of the Southern Baptist Convention at the time. The next day, and by the way, that was when Dr. Henry was in something of what might be described as a vagabond ministry. He was traveling a great deal. Confessions of a Theologian makes this very clear. He will say, I spoke here, and I spoke there, and I spoke the next place. And he would have gaps, and so we were not aware of the fact that when he came, his next engagement was not but 2 or 3 days out, and so he ended up staying here for some time, which turned out to be a tremendous blessing in my life. So I went to lunch with them the next day, and as I was walking across the lawn, I can tell you exactly where I was on the seminary lawn when Dr. Henry asked me a question out of the blue. He said, what is your position on women in the pastorate? And I answered, all had been happy up till that moment. At that moment, things turned cloudy. Dr. Henry turned to me after I had made my short but very clear answer, and he said, one day, you will be embarrassed to have made that argument. That was the day. When Dr. Henry made a statement like that, it was rather devastating at the time, but I was in no position to change my argument. I just had to go to lunch. Now, the background of that is, I was in a very different position. In 1984, the Southern Baptist Convention had adopted a resolution stating that the office of pastor was limited by Scripture to men, not to all men, but to those men who were qualified and called. I was actually a part of an argument to the contrary. Beyond that, I was actually the instigator of making a public statement, buying a full-page ad in the Courier-Journal, writing a manifesto about how wrong the Southern Baptist Convention was on that issue. I don't know if Dr. Henry knew that. My guess is someone in the Student Evangelical Fellowship had told him that. He looked at me over those glasses and said, again, one day you'll be embarrassed to have made this argument, to have held this position. Well, that night I went to Southern Seminary's library and tried to find everything I could find on the issue of the ordination of women, which wasn't much. This was before there was the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. This was before any of the literature was out there. As a matter of fact, the only book I could find was a book by a rather eccentric Roman Catholic entitled Man and Woman in Christ. That author was Stephen Clark. And yet, even in that book, I started to look at the biblical arguments and went beyond the book, just looking at Scripture. And just to speak very honestly, I realized I had the wrong position. I was in the wrong place. And furthermore, it was inconsistent with other commitments that I had made. And I was in a position at that time where the argument against the ordination of women wasn't made on the campus. It wasn't something I'd actually confronted before, but I confronted it in a singular individual who delivered it with singular power. But he didn't do it by making an argument, but simply making the fact that I would one day be embarrassed to hold that position. Well, that was indicative of how he could fulfill the role. As I said in Southern Seminary's chapel some time ago, it was the equivalent of taking Apollos aside and instructing him more accurately. He had a way of doing that, and for that I'm very grateful. We remained in contact, especially as I was writing my dissertation, and then as a part of the Pew-funded project on Southern Baptists and American Evangelicals, he came as visiting professor in the spring of 1987. And I had more time to talk with him and to be with him and to see how he worked. In 1989, I was elected editor of the Christian Index. That is the oldest newspaper serving the Southern Baptist Convention, indeed now the oldest religious periodical in America. And to be honest, there was only one man I really had as a role model that I could know of what it meant to be an editor. So I looked at Christianity Today under the Henry era as what I hoped to accomplish at the Christian Index. It turned out that the people in Georgia weren't looking to the same model in terms of what they were looking for, but it was nonetheless an exhilarating 4 years of writing what I thought would help Southern Baptists and Georgia Baptists in particular and Southern Baptists beyond to understand the issues. And I'm thankful to say, to some degree, at least it did, and to some degree it explains why I am standing here 20 years later. But nonetheless, when I was at the Christian Index, I immediately put Dr. Henry on the mailing list, and I would hear from him very regularly. He was never offering a critical word about my editorials. He would sometimes suggest other things that should be addressed, and then he would continue the argument. And then he would say, you could have said, then he would say, but you're always going to run out of space. And he usually wrote that in tiny little script at the end of the letter because he had just run out of space. In 1993, I was elected president of Southern Seminary. That came after I'd been asked to write that chapter that was published in the Dockery and George edited book, Baptist Theologians. When I was elected here, one of my main goals was to make a statement during the process of my inauguration in October of 1993 of the direction that Southern Seminary would and must take. And that was a time, the volatility of which is almost impossible to describe. But I asked several people to come and help us at that time. The first was Dr. Billy Graham, who came and not only spoke at my inauguration, but allowed us to name the only graduate school that bears his name, the Billy Graham School, here on this campus. He came and spoke. He spoke at an evening event that had to be moved to Freedom Hall here in Louisville. And it was a very memorable night. And I asked Dr. Henry to deliver the inaugural address at lunch. And Dr. Henry graciously agreed. And I had, on the day before the events began, Dr. Henry and Dr. Billy Graham here on the campus. And some of you who are aware of that story know that it had actually been several years since Dr. Henry and Dr. Graham had been together. And I've never been more thankful to have been able to stand in a place where we could create the context where the two would be back. And I thought I'd share at least a picture or two of that reunion of these two giants of the evangelical world as they were here in 1993. And you see the teenager standing amongst them. It was so special to have them together, and they stayed in my office for 2 hours just talking to one another, reminiscing and catching up with one another. And I can't see what you're seeing, but I hope you're seeing at some point Dr. Henry speaking at the luncheon. There you go. And what a memorable day that was, and how honored I was that Dr. Henry would come and deliver that address and be a part of that occasion. And while he was here, he gave an address entitled Theology in the Balance. You see him doing so in that photograph. At that time, he said, "This turning time in the history of Southern Seminary, at this time the institution can exert enormous influences in view of its role in the denomination and the manner in which theoretical and practical studies are coordinated and in which the great heritage is perpetuated." Again, that's a sentence. Long sentences, but you were hanging on every word. "There are always free spirits who think that theologians, like magicians, need only carry a special bag of tricks or think that a pastor's main asset is his ready effervescence and discharge of charismatic dynamism. Instead of looking to God and his self-disclosure, to the Bible and God's enduring promises, they look to self-esteem, to humanity and its potential." He said, "The time is ripe, therefore, to emphasize that truth is the highest asset the Christian religion can have. Nothing else much matters. The nature of God, the content of the Christian faith, redemption, regeneration, resurrection, and heaven and eternal bliss, if we remain only in the realm of myth, none of this matters. Yet theology once again hangs insecurely in the balances," he wrote and delivered here. "It is once again at a crucial stage, at a decisive juncture, at a critical turning point. We who profess to be its champions and to welcome it for what it authentically and genuinely presents need more aggressively to herald the direction it gives. The truth and justice it affirms, the grace and moral energy it offers, need a larger sounding board." He went on to say, "Even an inaugural occasion like this reminds us," and this is a very important word for the Baptists in the room, "an inaugural occasion like this reminds us that Baptists were among the earliest in founding Christian universities and seminaries. They've also had one of the poorest records in preserving their theological stability. We need more than two hands to count up the number of Baptist institutions that have gone down the drain doctrinally." You'll notice when he's critical, the sentences are shorter. "There are gratifying signs, however, of a recovery of academic heritage." Now, remember, this is 1993, and this will become important in just a moment. He said then, "Even the launching of a large Christian university in the New York, New Jersey area is again being discussed 60 years after it was first seriously probed. If a comprehensive Christian alternative to a prevalent secular outlook is to arrive, it will come from a Christian academia. The foes of Christian education," this is a great sentence, "the foes of Christian education can hardly be expected to respond critically to their own theories. The time has come," he said, "to put things right again. Theology may no longer be king or queen of the sciences, but that is not reason for demeaning it to a bargain basement closeout. From you, for whom the Word of God has come alive, the world waits for a message that throbs with the heart of God. It is time for all of us to do theology in the dark again. It is not too late for America if we stand true to the Savior and remain dedicated to His Word. Neither politics, nor the media, nor science, nor public education will make us truly happier or better or wiser. May the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary," he said, "serve as a theological terrain where the book and the Redeemer and the returning King become the source of our theological preoccupations and moral power. It's time for Reveille," he said, "and Louisville can lead the way again." Now, those are what can only be described as marching orders. And what a privilege it was to have Dr. Henry deliver that address, and how bracing and challenging were those words that he offered on that occasion. Shortly thereafter, in 1994, Dr. Henry and I were invited to a think tank meeting sponsored by the National Association of Evangelicals meeting at Geneva College. The issue was homosexuality, and the two of us were asked to deliver papers about how evangelicals, when that issue was becoming increasingly controversial, should think about the question and the issue. He presented a paper, I presented a paper, and we both then discussed it before the think tank that was then assembled. I was traveling to Beaver Falls by air, and we were both going through the Pittsburgh airport, And I was communicating with Dr. Henry, and he asked if we could travel from the airport together. It was at that point that I realized, as I was trying to find him in the Pittsburgh airport, that that he was not able to get himself to these places alone as he once was, and I could not find him in the airport. We had to page him in the airport. We eventually had to have the airport security help to find him. And when they found him, he was in an overcoat, sitting on a bench with his briefcase, with a book open and a pen, making notes in the book. And I went up to him and I said, "Dr. Henry, we've been looking for you." And he said, "I've been here reading." And I realized, yes, that's exactly where he would expect we would come find him, would be on a bench reading. Perfect picture of Carl Henry. In 1994, that same year, Mark Dever was called as pastor of the Capitol Hill Metropolitan Baptist Church, which was the church of which Dr. Henry had been a member for several decades. And it was Dr. Henry who was the original impetus in Mark Dever being called as pastor of that church. And we were together on the occasion of Dr. Dever being installed. And that was 19 years ago yesterday, I believe. That same year, I served as editor, as general editor, of one of his final books. The book was entitled The Gods of This Age, or God of the Ages, published by Brodmann and Holman. And Dr. Henry had asked that I do that. Dr. Dockery edited another volume, both of them drawn from papers. His was on Christology, and mine was on issues of God, revelation, and authority. You might say the things that didn't make it into the book, the six-volume series were in this volume. And that's when I discovered that once an editor, always an editor. Dr. Henry not only edited his own work, he edited my editing of his work. And that was quite an experience. I learned a great deal from that. At one point, however, it led to a situation in which I had to reach a new level of self-understanding. There was a particular line, I'll never forget this, because the word indicates was used in the sentence, and he wrote me back and said, "That is a problem, because I do not mean merely to indicate, but to demonstrate." And then he wrote a paragraph on the difference between what it would mean merely to indicate and then to demonstrate. And I will admit that my feelings were hurt. And so I was tempted to send him back his original manuscript that said indicates, not demonstrates. But even as I was getting ready to do that, I thought, that's not what I should do. I should simply make the change and leave it as it is. And I was going to leave it right there and never mention it. And the next time I was with Dr. Henry, he said, "Do you really understand the distinction between indicates and demonstrates?" Yes. Yes, sir, I do. And left it there. In 1999, on January the 22nd, which was Carl Henry's 86th birthday, he came back to this campus, and at that point, we had named him Senior Professor of Christian Theology, and we had hoped that at some point he would be able to have at least an episodic classroom ministry here. He was unable to do that, but he was able to come, and on that date, we were able to celebrate the fact that God, Revelation, and Authority had been republished under the co-sponsorship of Southern Seminary and Crossway Books. And that is a very happy day, and I look back to it with great satisfaction and tremendous satisfaction, and Dr. Henry being so pleased that his six-volume magnum opus would be perpetuated in print, and it is available in Southern Seminary's bookstore and at your local bookseller, and even now, in a way that it would not be if Crossway had not been willing to go to the investment to make that set published once again. My friendship with Dr. Henry is one of the kindest gifts he could have given me. His interest in me and in my ministry, and in the ministry of this school and in Southern Baptist, was generous, and it was continuing all the way to his death. It's in terms of letters and cards and contacts. When I concluded my chapter in Baptist Theologians, I wrote this: Dr. Henry has been recognized by evangelicals and non-evangelicals alike as the premier representative of the evangelical movement in the last half of the 20th century. As E.G. Homrighausen of Princeton Theological Seminary remarked, "Carl Henry has championed evangelical Christianity with clarity of language, comprehensiveness of scholarship, clarity of mind, and vigor of spirit. Baptists and their fellow evangelicals stand in his debt." I stand by that assessment 100 years after his birth all the more. And I understand my own words all the better. I argue once again that Carl Henry is the essential evangelical as we look to the 20th century. You just think about his addresses, whether you think of those addresses as Wheaton College and Fuller Theological Seminary and Christianity Today and beyond. And then you think of his associations with everything from the Pacific Garden Mission and the Moody Bible Institute to the Prison Fellowship and World Vision. You think of the Berlin Congress on Evangelism, and you think of so many events and personages and movements and organizations in the evangelical world that bear not only his imprint, but often look to him for at least part of their origin. But in arguing that Carl Henry is rightly understood as the essential evangelical, again, I argue that that is not alone. There were others who were essential with him. But nonetheless, I want to speak today in closing on evangelical ambition and Carl Henry as a portrait of evangelical ambition in the 20th century. In order to do that, we have to set some historical context. The roots for this ambition certainly are found before World War II in the wreckage of American fundamentalism. This was ambition driven by a sense of urgency that was mixed with opportunity. Sometimes, perhaps, difficult to know which was greater, the opportunity or the urgency. Carl Henry's birth and the very year before the First World War placed him in one of the most transformative periods of human history. It also placed him in one of the most urgent moments of the history of American Christianity, certainly biblical Christianity. It is churlish and condescending to suggest that fundamentalism was entirely a failed project. If nothing else, it was forced upon many who were later called fundamentalists, simply by the fact that they were cast out of denominations, cast out of structures, and eliminated from the opportunity of influence or engagement. But there is also good reason, there are good grounds for understanding fundamentalism as a failure. That failure, those who became known as the New Evangelical saw, was rooted in an anti-intellectualism, cultural disengagement, doctrinal eccentricity, pugilistic infighting, and the assured marginalization of a movement that complained about being marginalized, but worked hard at times, seemingly, to be marginalized. Those who became known as the New Evangelicals were looking in two different directions. They looked backwards in what may be called a rearview mirror, and there they saw the collapse of obscurantist fundamentalism. And they understood that was not only a failed project, it was a closed option. There was no house there in which to live. There was no mode of moving forward. And you see in the writings of these early neo-evangelicals, as they would call themselves, a sense almost of desperation. There has to be some way to perpetuate classical Christianity, what we might call Orthodox Christianity, in a modern world, and yet without all of the shackles and the embarrassments of fundamentalism. But if they were looking backwards in the rearview mirror and they saw the collapse of fundamentalism, they also had binoculars in order to look to the future and see the collapse of liberal Protestantism. And looking at so much of this literature just in recent weeks and months, I've been surprised once again by how prescient these neo-evangelicals were about the collapse of liberal Protestantism, because that was anything but obvious. And frankly, it remained anything but obvious for a very long time after they began making these observations. All you have to do is look at Will Herberg's book, A Protestant Catholic Jew, or look at the National Council of Churches and Conciliar Protestantism, even after the Second World War, even well into the 1960s. It's hard to see that as an institutional collapse. But as Dr. Henry wrote in Christianity Today during his editorship, there are pillars missing and foundations crumbling. And as he said, liberal Protestantism simply cannot answer the questions that a modern society is forcing upon it in any compelling way. The result of the collapse of liberal Protestantism, they foresaw, would be not only the abandonment of biblical authority and doctrinal essentials, but a retreat from the mission fields and a perpetual mode of cultural accommodationism. So the new evangelicalism became their dream and their vision. It became a very clear ambition, an ambition to project a reinvigorated Christianity that was truly orthodox and biblical and comprehensively, even boldly, engaged. It is now clear to me that Carl Henry arrived at Wheaton College as a student in 1935 with at least the embryonic form of this ambition, driven by his Christian passion, but also by his experience as a young journalist. Someone needs to do a doctoral dissertation going and looking at the secular work of Carl Henry with Long Island newspapers and then with Manhattan newspapers, looking at the issues he covered. Because you're talking about the era in which you had the rise of international organizations, of massive organizations. If I could show you a slide just to make the point about the kinds of ambitions I'm talking about here, I would show you the Mall in Washington, D.C. before and after the Second World War. Before World War II, there were a bunch of wooden buildings on the Mall, and not so many of those, as a matter of fact. But by the time you get to the 1950s, you have these massive structures, these organizations in which you have an alphabet soup of international and national organizations. And you have this enormous ambition, not only national but global, for influence and organizational breadth and reach. It's clear to me that Carl Henry arrived at Wheaton with at least a part of that ambition, which explains why he networked and made the friends and associations he did, and why he shared with others, including Billy Graham and several of the others who were there at Wheaton, an institutional, an organizational, a great commission ambition that gave fruit to so many ministries. There at Wheaton, he met friends who would with him become the luminaries of the new evangelicalism. Their shared vision was marked by an almost unbridled ambition. There was a personal ambition to this. That becomes very clear when you see the young men who are in certain photographs and all the rest, and you look at statements such as from the young Billy Graham and those who were around him in Youth for Christ and in other movements, as well as what became the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association and all the rest. There was a boldness and there was a personal ambition, but the far greater ambition was an evangelical ambition. Carl Henry drove, shaped, publicized, edited, advertised, criticized, rationalized, and institutionalized that ambition. This was an ambition to reawaken and rescue conservative Christianity, to engage the mind of the age with the revealed truths of God's Word, to marshal the finest minds and to seize the intellectual opportunity, to build a great evangelical empire and to organize evangelicals worldwide into a massive, world-changing Great Commission movement. Together, these neo-evangelicals intended to meet the theological liberals on their own ground. That was the ground especially of academia and elite intellectual centers. Carl Henry went beyond that, of course, and he argued in Christianity Today that it wasn't enough to change minds, you had to change policies. And repeatedly within his editorials, he would make the argument that we need to change laws and policies. We need to reshape institutions. It's not enough to get agreement on cognitive issues if it doesn't have a practical effect. But he always knew that the cognitive issues came first. The intention, the ambition of these new evangelicals was to meet theological liberals on their own ground and beat them at their own game. And in particular, the arenas of theology and philosophy. They wanted to build even greater institutions than liberal Protestantism had built. And unlike the mainline Protestants, they intended to retain them for evangelical faithfulness. They wanted not only to engage the culture, but to reshape the culture. And I'm going to have to, for sake of time, just eliminate a lot of the documentation of this, but the language found in the editorials in Christianity Today, the language found even in the latter writings of Carl Henry, as well as others, Ockenguy and Billy Graham, reflect an incredible ambition. And that ambition was institutional and organizational. It was an ambition for a movement that would unify gospel Christians around the world for common concerns and would have a world-shaping influence. Try telling that story without Carl Henry. You could not talk rightly of Billy Graham, Fuller Theological Seminary, or, most importantly, Christianity Today. The same would be true of a host of other central events, institutions, and centers of influence within the evangelical movement. Without Carl Henry, the story would be a very different story, and some stories could not even be told, for they would not exist. To speak of Carl Henry is to tell the story of evangelical ambition in all of its glory. The conferences, colleges, seminaries, publishing houses, evangelistic organizations, youth movements, mission agencies, and congregations. But to tell a story is also to speak honestly about the failures of that evangelical ambition. Its overreach, its personality conflicts, its celebrity culture, its unfulfilled dreams, and its own accommodations, both cultural and theological. The institutional ambitions were not without tremendous effect. As a matter of fact, it's fitting when you look at the partners who are joining together to sponsor this conference. It's evidence of the fact that those evangelical ambitions were not unrealized, even if they were not completely fulfilled. Just to speak of Fuller Theological Seminary and Christianity Today, the National Association of Evangelicals, the Evangelical Theological Society, is to speak of institutions that are very much alive. But when you speak of a great evangelical university in the New York, New Jersey area, it never did materialize. I was actually surprised when I went back and read his address at my inauguration that late he was still talking about that idea and the fact that conversations were then very much underway about the possibility of doing it. I will not cite this evangelical leader, but many, many years ago I talked to him about this, and he has said most of those conversations are going on in Carl Henry's brain. Simply because he had the dream he would not let die. But it was a dream that I think in historical perspective was late. As a matter of fact, there are very few major universities that have emerged de novo out of that very period, whether evangelical or otherwise. As a matter of fact, a recent major volume on higher education points out that it is virtually impossible to now found what would be a major research university. The example that was given there is the fact that when the Stanford University was begun, or even when the University of Chicago was begun, it was begun by philanthropists who at the time individually, at one point John Rockefeller, controlled 1% of what we would now call the gross national product or the gross domestic product of the United States. If you have that, you can start a great research university. But let's also remind ourselves that it didn't look as it looks now. That was virtually a century ago. So the age of building these great universities had already passed by the time that Dr. Henry had this dream. And the dream lives on, but it lives on in individuals, it lives on in scholars, it lives on in scholarly organizations, and we hope it lives on in institutional representations such as King's College and others in the New York, New Jersey area. And the reason he said that is the reason that's so important is because at one meeting in the 1970s, and I think Owen Strand's written about this and others as well, Dr. Henry insisted that it could only be one of two places. It had to be in Boston or in the New York area, because otherwise it really didn't matter intellectually. And in the very first issue of Christianity Today, location becomes very, very important. Read that editorial and that facsimile and look at the end where he says, "I write these words as I look down Pennsylvania Avenue and see the White House and Blair House." One of the issues of his greatest disappointment about Christianity Today was that it moved to Wheaton. He believed that evangelicals needed to be in situ, located in the great centers where the culture was being shaped. And he believed that, whether it was a university or the magazine that he so dearly loved. These institutional ambitions, well, they live on. Some of them would please Dr. Henry more than others. But quite frankly, it's something of a miracle of a sort that they actually do exist. When you consider what the evangelical founders established that has lasted, it is absolutely massive, even if all of their dreams were not realized. There were theological ambitions. And once again, I look back at the 40-plus books written by Carl Henry, and I realize that no one since has written anything of that stature. And that is not to depreciate any scholar or thinker thereafter. And frankly, I'm not sure that there have been many who would actually have aspired to have done a project quite as that. But the evangelical movement we know today would not be what it is today had Carl Henry not written that library as a singular individual. Culture and political ambitions. For Dr. Henry, those keep coming out again and again and again. Even in his Augustinian worldview, he understood the limitations of politics. He also understood the importance of politics. In terms of personal ambitions, well, Dr. Henry, at the end of the day, held many positions of great influence, but his personal ambitions were not so much about an office he held or a title that was granted to him, but rather a purpose that had been invested in him. And his personal ambitions were always driven back, as he made clear over and over again, to his conversion. When someone told him about Jesus and he believed, and then he knew himself, as he said, to be completely owned by a Savior whose servant he meant to be. In 1986, in his memoir, Confessions of an Evangelical Theologian, he said this: "I have two main convictions about the near-term future of American Christianity. One is that American evangelicals presently face their biggest opportunity since the Protestant Reformation, if not since the Apostolic Age. The other is that Americans are forfeiting that opportunity stage by stage, despite the fact that evangelical outcomes in the 20th century depend on decisions currently in the making. Our ambitions may be somewhat different than those of the evangelical movement's founders, but they are no more noble. Chastened by the realities of a new century and its challenges, I identify without hesitation or compromise upon the theological tradition and confession that Carl Henry and his friends so capably defined, defended, and declared. We stand not only in their debt, but in their shadows. In an age which will require of us an even greater theological clarity and theological wisdom, may we be worthy to pick up the mantle they've handed to us. Shortly before his death, Dr. Henry wrote this: "Our weak batteries can be recharged by a jump cable that reconnects believers to the divine current held in store for us by our supernatural Creator, Preserver, and Redeemer. We rely too much on our own finite power and world energy. We are dazzled by technology more than by theology and morality. To gain God's empowerment for mission, we must first acknowledge our vulnerabilities and our spiritual immaturity. Beyond our lifetime, if Christ tarries, others will run the relay and carry the torch. For us, in the rocky terrain of the present-day cultural conflict, the time is now, and the race is now." Well, for some time now, the race has been over for Carl F. H. Henry, the essential evangelical. The real question is this: will the present generation of evangelicals run the race or run from the challenge? Thank you, and God bless you.